I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Our guest this hour, Jeff Benedict, has written a kind of civil action saga about the world's biggest Indian casino. It's the story of how lawyers, politicians, activists turned a nearly defunct Indian reservation on a few hundred acres in southern Connecticut into not just the biggest casino in the world, but the wealthiest and most powerful Indian tribe in the country. Along the way, serious questions of lineage and legal practice have emerged. The success of the Pequot Reservation's Foxwoods Casino has turned a national spotlight on Indian tribal recognition and sovereignty. Most Indian reservations are by and large underdeveloped, but a significant minority have followed the Pequot model and built remarkable wealth over the last decade through casino gambling. Another 200 tribes nationwide are on the waiting list for federal recognition. There's big money at stake and a dysfunctional federal bureaucracy breaking down under the pressure. Jeff Benedict's book, Without Reservation, has jump-started an idling issue. It's got congressional and Johnny Cochran kind of attention now. Maybe the core of the question, Connection listeners, is who's an Indian? What does America owe them? And what does casino gambling have to do with it all? Jeff Benedict is our guest in the studio. By phone from Sacramento, our guest is Dennis Chappabitty. He's a lawyer and a member of the Comanche Indian tribe. I'd like to start with you, Jeff Benedict. You have told this tortuous story over a 30-year period of sort of title searches and every kind of research into records by obsessively dedicated lawyers. Dedicated to what is another question. How did it come to, in 1992, to this kind of Vegas in the Connecticut woods?
Well, it started in the early 1970s when a young lawyer came into out of law school and discovered this legal theory where he could sue to recover Indian land for ancient tribes. At the time, the Mashantucket Pequots did not exist. There was a vacant reservation in Connecticut of 200 acres. And this lawyer sent some researchers out and eventually discovered a guy named Skip Hayward, who was a descendant of someone who used to live on the reservation. These guys filed a lawsuit in 1976 where they alleged they were the original Pequot tribe and tried to recover the reservation and also some land around it. The lawsuit languished until the 1980s. By then, Ronald Reagan's in office, and this lawyer goes to Congress with Skip Hayward and asks Congress to settle this lawsuit, make it go away, and in the process, please recognize this group as a sovereign Indian tribe. Ronald Reagan fights this and actually vetoes the legislation, and his reason for it is, we don't know who these people are. We have no evidence that they're not only that they're not Indians, but they're not Pequots. And this gets vetoed down, and then Lowell Weicker, who was a senior senator and a Republican at that time in Connecticut, gets enough votes to override Ronald Reagan's veto. They go back and make a deal with Reagan, and he had not been overridden at that point in his history. But he sees here that there will be an override, so he gives up on his challenge to their legitimacy and signs off on the legislation. Nobody understood at the time what was about to happen. This is 1983. Indian gaming is illegal at this point. There are no casinos on any Indian reservations. Suddenly, this tribe is given the authority to do what any other Native American tribe could do. Immediately after Reagan signs this legislation in October of 83, this small band of people, which were at that time one family that descended from Skip Hayward, his siblings, his mother, etc., they immediately begin the process of planning to bring organized gambling to Ledyard, Connecticut. There was foresight. There was pre-planning. Within 3 weeks, they announced plans to bring a humongous bingo hall there. And right after that, Skip Hayward starts testifying and lobbying in Congress to get the passage of what ultimately became the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. In 1988, Congress passes that. This so-called tribe becomes the first tribe in America to file a lawsuit under that act for the right to build a casino. Connecticut has no idea what this is about. They go to court to fight it. They lose. And this tribe builds a casino in 1992. It's Foxwoods. It becomes the biggest casino in the world. It takes in $1.3 billion. And today, there are 650 adults in that tribe claiming to be Pequots, when in 1973 there were zero, and there was nobody on that reservation.
Are you sure you're not a Pequot, or that I'm not a Pequot?
Under their definition, we probably could be.
What is the definition of a Pequot?
The definition has changed since 1973 to now. They continuously alter it. In 1973, when they started to organize, they set a standard that said you had to be a 1/8 or 1/16 Pequot, meaning that you had to have some blood connection through lineage to an ancient descendant of that tribe. Today, in the year 2000, there is absolutely no blood quantum requirement. You don't have to have any genealogy whatsoever that links you to the ancient tribe. It is essentially a private matter where you apply to the tribe like you would a club, and if the membership committee in the tribe approves you, you're in.
Obviously, Skip Haywood and his lawyers, you say they applied foresight and pre-planning to this thing. They knew vastly more about it than the people who were signing this, voting on this legislation and signing the deals. Would you go beyond that, though, to say that they hoodwinked anybody? Was there fraud here? Was there deception? Is Skip Haywood himself really an Indian? You question that. He signed a marriage license as white. There is obviously, as you say, more planning on one side than on the other. But was there something like fraud?
There's no question that there was fraud and deception. I mean, what I did was first of all, I went back and looked at vital records, and these would be government documents that Skip Haywood and his family had been filling out prior to deciding to file this lawsuit. And on every document that I discovered, and we're talking about marriage license, birth certificates, death certificates, this family consistently identified themselves as what they are, white or Caucasian. There is no mention of being Native American, American Indian, or Pequot. When they go to Congress and ask them to settle their lawsuit and recognize them as a tribe, there's testimony given before the Senate and House committees where they are specifically asked, do they have the documentation to prove that they have lineage to the Pequot tribe? And they repeatedly say, yes, they do. But their attorney asks the Congress not to go into all that because of how time-consuming it would be for the Congress to review all these documents. And there's an assurance given to the Congress that there is a wealth of documentation available to prove that they are Pequots. In fact, there wasn't. And to this day, the tribe has never turned over any documentation to anybody in Congress or anybody else to prove who they are.
In your book, the Bureau of Indian Affairs list, the sort of checklist of things you have to prove sounds rather strict. There's got to be proof that the petitioner had been identified as a tribe, proof that a majority of the members, as well as their ancestors, inhabited the area in or around the reservation, proof that they'd been recognized as a Indian community distinct from other populations, evidence that the tribe maintained political influence over its members, etc., evidence of a written governing document such as a constitution. Whatever happened to those standards?
Every one of these standards were deficient for this group, and that is why originally they applied to the Bureau of Indian Affairs like any other petitioning group would. But right after they applied, they decided not to continue with that process, knowing they were deficient. They went directly to Congress and asked Congress to simply go around the requirements of the BIA and recognize them through a congressional act, which Congress has the power to do, but rarely does that. They leave that to the BIA because the BIA is the one with the regulations and the ability to go through this process. This tribe never went through that process, and that's perhaps the most startling thing here is they didn't have any of the qualifications. And the other interesting thing is you were talking about lawyers a minute ago. This started out as a lawsuit, and this group that called themselves a tribe sued some landowners in Connecticut saying they were on Indian land. Their lawyer, the defendant's landowner lawyer, went to Congress, and he, too, begged the Congress to recognize this. Mm. He's now general counsel for the tribe. Since it's opened Foxwoods and brings in $1 billion a year, he works for them now. He used to work for the landowners that were sued. He asked Congress to do this. He too promised Congress that they had all the records that they needed, and Congress never checked because they're taking the word of attorneys and a guy who called himself a chief. If they looked at these records today, they would be stunned to find out who these people really are.
Let me ask you, Jeff, I mean, cut to the chase of what might be done now. Your argument here is that this incredible churn of money known as Foxwoods, is built, legally speaking, on a cobweb of dubious claims of identity, tribal history, connection among the players. Do you think it should be taken away? Can it be undone? And it goes without saying that there's lots of people who think casinos in every corner are a lousy idea for an American society, but whatever they are, do the Indians have good title to this fortune now or not?
Well, I would start by rephrasing the question, because they're not Indians, but does this group have good title? They do, but I think we have to remember that this group and their title and right to this casino is all predicated or hinges solely on a federal law that Congress passed in 1983. The law can be amended. The law can be revoked. I think the practical question is, will Foxwoods go away? And the answer is obviously no. It employs 12,000 people and generates $1 billion a year. But the question
is, how much does it pay in Connecticut taxes?
Zero. Connecticut gets nothing in taxes from that casino, nor do the communities that host it. The only thing Connecticut gets out of this is they get 25% of the slot revenues, which is always over $100 million a year that they get. But that's all they get. And when you're talking about $1.3 billion a year in revenue, Connecticut's getting chump change, and all the communities around the casino get nothing. And I think what can be done and should be done here is not closing down the casino and taking it away, because that's never going to happen. But should this tribe be stripped of its sovereign status and all the privileges and immunities that are reserved for Indian tribes? And the answer to that is yes. And I think the government can do that and should do that.
Well, let's just take a hard look at that point. Part of the reason this whole casino gambling business has gotten so awkward is that the society at large doesn't know what to do about the Indian claims and doesn't know what to do about our own sort of universal American responsibility for wiping out the native population of this continent. Should nothing be done? Is there, what is a more prudent, wiser resolution of the general claim of Indian justice, in your view?
Well, I think, first of all, this group doesn't fit into that category at all, because these are people who never experienced the kind of injustices we're talking about. In fact, you could argue that these people descend from people who carried out those injustices. But I think your larger question here is, how do we compensate people for something that happened as far back as 400 years ago? The Pequots existed in the early 1600s, and they were decimated in a war that took place back then. Who do we hold accountable today? Most of the people who live in America today descend from or come from countries that had nothing to do with that war. How do we hold them accountable for what happened 400 years ago, particularly when there don't appear to be any descendants left from that tribe? I think you get on a very awkward and dangerous road when you start trying to do compensation today for injustices that happened before the formation of the United States of America. I don't think we're equipped to do it. Who do we're talking about land that was owned by a tribe before the formation of this government in this country. And the people who live here today have good title to that land. What do? Take it away from them and give it back to a defunct tribe? I mean, these are the kinds of questions that this issue raises. And I think that there comes a point where you have to let bygones be bygones. And this is one of those.
This is the Foxwoods Casino Connection with Jeff Benedict, whose book about it is called Without Reservation. The larger question is justice for American Indians. What does it have to do with the reconstitution of what he's calling defunct Indian tribes and licensing them with casinos? 1-800-423-8255 makes the Foxwoods connection. Dennis Chappabitty joins us by phone from California. He's a lawyer and a Comanche Indian with offices in Sacramento, California. Dennis Chappabitty, we've covered a lot of ground about the Foxwoods scene. I wonder how a Western Native American views this kind of story.
Well, right now, Mr. Benedict and the folks out there, what we're dealing with is, once again, just another the Indian problem. And I put quotes around the term Indian problem. For ages and ages, every time the Indians have achieved some sort of a level in society to where they are perceived by majority white folks as being dangerous because they're now able to participate, then the flag goes up and people like Mr. Benedict start running forward and writing books and questioning who's an Indian. Well, first of all, Mr. Benedict, have you taken a look at the documents of the tribe? Have you observed what it is in those documents? Have you?
As a matter of fact, I have.
Okay, and your findings indicate what?
Well, that they are not a tribe and that they're not Native Americans. And it's ironic, you're saying that every time the Indians achieve something that white people come out and start trying to attack it. These are white people. That's the point here is that
Native Americans. That's according to Jeff Benedict that they're
no,
white
No, it's
people.
According to government documents. It's according to every record that this group filled out prior to getting recognized in 1983. And my question to you is, have you ever looked at the documents?
I have not looked at the documents.
Well, you should, because if you looked at the documents, I think as a Native American, you'd probably be appalled to find out that here's a group of people.
No, I would not be appalled because I have looked and examined from the various levels of my client's interest ancient documents going back to the 1800s in many cases involving enrollment disputes, and it would have been a death sentence in many cases to have stated that you were an Indian of a particular tribe back in the 1800s and early 1900s.
I'm talking about 1970s, contemporary times, and it wasn't a death sentence in the mid-70s to put on a government document that you were a Native American, and I think you know that. By the late 60s, there was an enormous movement afoot, particularly in the East, to improve the situation and the political status of Native American tribes, Eastern tribes specifically. This group was in that process, yet they were not identifying themselves as Native Americans. We're not talking about the 1850s. We're talking about the 1970s.
So you seem to be hung up on the one notation of being white on a particular marriage.
I don't think racial is the issue. The issue here, as you know, under the BIA standards, you have to have a cohesive tribal entity in place continuously back to the first contact with Europeans. What I'm saying is that in the 1960s and 70s, these people now calling themselves Pequots were living everywhere but on the reservation and doing everything but acting as a tribe.
Dennis Chaffavitti, could I ask you, you undoubtedly have to mediate contests of who's got a claim, who's an Indian, who's in on whatever the project is. How do you sort them out?
Well, what I look at in terms of who's an Indian and who's not is, so once again, we go to what the white man has set out of standards, which are those things that you tick off on the sheet of paper for federal recognition, continuous governance, et cetera, and all those things. But I look a little bit deeper. I look into what that person believes, whether or not they believe that they are descendant of a particular tribe or a particular view or a thought. Now, I might draw your attention to the fact that in Oklahoma in 1901 or thereabouts during the Dawes allotment period where Indians had land stolen from them, I characterize, one particular act of Congress and an order of the Indian commissioner allowed almost 15 white people to be placed on the rolls of the Wichita Indian tribe in order to encourage the chiefs not to file suit against the allotment of their lands, but to bring on white people who were deemed to be influential enough to convince the chiefs not to file suit against the allotment of their land and to go on. This was a ruse by the United States government to convince the tribes, don't file suit, we're going to let these influential white men that have been living among you for a long time on board, and they were adopted into the Wichita tribe. So once again, we have Congress engaging in a particular action that put white people in as Indians, and no one made any beef about that.
Well, I think I just want to respond to something you said. You were asked a second ago how you determine who's Indian and who isn't. And you said the white man set up a standard. Well, first of all, the BIA set those standards up. And as you know, the BIA is run exclusively by Native Americans. And second of all, if you used your standard, you just said you ask what a person believes.
Yes.
If that standard were implicated in the state of Connecticut, for example, where it is casino country, think of what that would do to a state. Anybody who so-called believes they're a Native American can become a tribe and has the right to open a casino conveniently between New York City and Boston. And that is exactly what's going on in Connecticut. There are 9 petitioners right now who claim to be tribes. And I'm telling you that in 1600, there weren't 9 Indian tribes in Connecticut. You tell me how there could legitimately be that many there today.
Okay, well, and you're going to get rich also off of the current flap, aren't you?
How do you define rich?
Well, being able to pay your electricity bills and other things like that. Is that
paying a bill? I don't think I know where you're going here.
Well, what I'm saying here is this book that you have written, Lambasting the Mashantucket Pequots, is going to be fairly lucrative as long as you can keep the embers burning and the flames rolling. Am I correct or not?
I think you're probably not correct, because when I think of lucrative, I think of $1 billion a year for a casino. That's lucrative. What I'm going to get for this book is would probably stun you if you knew what I were paid to write this book. I mean, I wrote this book when I was in law school. And trust me, I'm not getting John Grisham kind of money to write this book.
Okay, then your motives then are helping the white man put the Indians down. Is that correct?
No, my motive is to write a book that people, when they come back and read it, say that was a worthwhile read. I mean, that's what I do for a living. Not trying to bring anybody down. It's just I think that you and probably the Mashantuckets and others like you have a problem with dealing with the reality and the truth that's in this issue. This is not about Indians.
I want to give Dennis an open shot here. Dennis Chapavitti, may I ask, I mean, do you see Indian claims out there that you reject out of hand as phony? I mean, aren't there some people, would you recognize a phony Indian if you saw one, I guess, is the question?
Well, definitely, yes.
What would the earmarks be?
Well, the earmarks would be someone that just, for instance, comes in and tries to participate in the ceremonies and the rituals, tries to ingrain themselves with certain families or groups, and tries to move on to the reservations and without really having any substantial prior connection. And I know you're going to jump on that, Mr. Benedict, aren't you? But
well, you just described the Pequots. That's what I like about it, is you've even pointed out that's exactly what happened here. And beyond that, I don't know if you're aware of this, but they've got a $200 million museum down there that's touted as the greatest Indian museum in the country. And just 2 weeks ago, it was revealed, and this had nothing to do with me, it was revealed by Passamaquoddy Indians who paid a visit to that museum that since the museum's opened, the language that's spoken there isn't Pequot, after all, it's Passamaquoddy. It's another example of the fakeness of this tribe, and they're now posting signs in the museum to inform visitors that they don't even speak Pequot here. They speak another tribe's language who they had never given any credit to. It's just, it's a long litany of things. And I just think, I agree with a lot of things you're saying, except when you apply them to this group, I just think you're doing yourself no good, no benefit.
Well, I believe I am, because once again, we're looking at Native Americans, and I'm not going to open up questions regarding what I believe they are, what they aren't. I'm saying that we have a right to push certain issues, the tribes, people who believe themselves to be members of Indian tribes, even though you call them ancient, they're living today. Their descendants are living, and we've got a right to push these issues and to do like any person in the United States has a right to do, which is to push them in courts of law.
I don't disagree with you on that. I don't disagree with that for a second. I'm simply saying to you is, would you approve of a group of people moving over here from Korea, for example, showing up and going in and saying, we want to be an Indian tribe now, and getting a reservation and opening a casino? I mean, that's essentially what's going on here.
Well, that's stretching it a little bit too far, and I wouldn't agree with that.
Stand by for calls. Our guest, Jeff Benedict, in his book, Without Reservation, questions the whole lineage and identity of the Indians who've made a huge fortune at the Foxwoods Casino in Connecticut. Give them a call at 1-800-423-8255. Dennis Chapavitti is a Comanche Indian, joins us today from his law office in Sacramento. Julie is on the line.
Yes, hi. Thank you for your show.
Thank you, Julie. Thanks for calling.
I spent a tremendous amount of time with traditional Mohawk people in the 80s. I'm an Anglo, not an Indian. And they actually had an anti-casino viewpoint, which I share. But there's a problem here, and that is any nation that hasn't signed a treaty is sovereign. If there is one person left with enough blood to claim that they're of the nation, they are an independent body, and they have a right to make decisions. And we are stuck in a hard place, and I really think this kind of thinking is sour grapes. We kill them. And there are, it's so complex. There are nations that still have language. There are nations that have thousands of people. There are nations that have a handful of people who don't have language. But basically, We, you know, gave them smallpox blankets. We took their land. This is all documented history. And now it's sour grapes when these people get their acts together and have viable economic ventures. And it's not our choice.
Well, I'm just going to ask you the question. When you say we killed them, who is we and who is them?
Okay, I have Mayflower ancestry.
Well, so does Skip Hayward, the founder of this tribe. His father's ancestors came over on the Mayflower. What are you talking about here?
Well,
he's the chief. And his father's ancestors came over on the Mayflower.
May I point out that there's such huge generalizations. You've got nations like the Hopi and the Navajo. You've got nations like the Wampanoag, who are a very intact nation but no longer have language. But slaves ran away and intermarried with the Wampanoag. A lot of Wampanoags are black. A lot of New England Indians have blue eyes. This doesn't make them not Indians. And I just think there's... I feel you need to be careful because you're missing a lot of racism and a lot of just sour grapes that people don't have the right.
Well, I think that you're missing the fact that I'm talking about a specific group of people in Connecticut. I'm not talking about Indian tribes around the country or even in the Eastern Corridor. I'm not talking about the Wampanoags. I'm talking about a group of people who claim to be Mashantucket Pequots who are not. And I have very carefully documented that. You can look at these records. They're out there. And I think when you say we killed them, that is the biggest generalization I've ever heard.
Stand by, Jeff Benedict. We're talking about the Pequot Indian claims to their Foxwood Casino in Connecticut. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
From Boston University.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Foxwoods Connection. We're talking about Jeff Benedict's book called Without Reservation, in which he argues that the claim of Indian identity and tribal continuity that underlies the biggest casino in the world now in eastern Connecticut is all phony, essentially phony. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Indian casino gambling connection. Dennis Chappabitty is a Comanche Indian, a lawyer who joins us from his office in San Francisco, in Sacramento, rather. Matthew Snipp teaches sociology at Stanford. Matthew Snipp, give us a short course on how Indians have been defined historically by themselves, by the U.S. government, and how it bears on the Foxwoods argument.
Well, I'm not sure I can do that in 2 minutes or less.
We'll give you 2.5.
Okay. The way Indian people have sort of historically defined themselves is anybody that belongs to their community. And in fact, when the Choctaw were removed from the southeast, the enroll included a very large number of white people as well as Indians and assorted African Americans at that time. The Bureau of Indian Affairs is sort of historically used to count people as Indians taxed or not taxed. And then later, in terms of blood quantum, which was sort of based on this notion that as Indians became civilized, they'd have less and less blood quantum. It was because, you know, it was presumed that cultural characteristics were inherited, that they were genetic, and that over time, as you had less and less blood quantum, Indians would become more and more civilized. And that was a notion that persisted well into the early part of the 20th century. Today, it's kind of a hodgepodge. American Indians are people who self-identify themselves. They are people who belong to Indian tribes. They are people who have, you know, a certain blood quantum. A lot of different ways. It's an enormously complicated subject.
I should have, in introducing you, said that you have Cherokee and Choctaw blood yourself, Matthew Snipp. How would you identify Pequot Indians of Connecticut who are making this claim, and how would you sort of build a claim that would sustain kind of legal and political examination on this matter of holding casino licenses, not to mention all this land?
Well,
what would the acid test be?
Well, I mean, there are the federal government standards, and the and Jeff Benedict said a minute ago that the Bureau of Indian Affairs is run exclusively by Indians. That's not true. I mean, the Bureau of Indian Affairs is ultimately operated by Bruce Babbitt, who's the Secretary of Interior, who I presume is not American Indian.
And he doesn't run the BIA. I mean, what I said is true, that the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which is under the Interior Department, is controlled by Native Americans.
Well,
it is, and you know it is.
Well, you know, okay, we can argue about what constitutes administers and who runs. I want to go back to something you said at the top of the hour in introducing this. I think it's important for people to understand. First of all, Pequots didn't originate gaming. This was something that first began in Florida and then spread around the country after the Seminole v. Butterworth case. And then the other thing that's important to understand, too, is that gaming is not a compensatory matter. It's something that tribes can do by virtue of their retained rights of sovereignty. And so when we talk about gaming as compensatory, I mean, that's really beside the point. The real issue is whether or not tribes have the right to do this in the same way that states have the right to have lotteries.
I agree with you, but I think, you know, as you know, the Seminole case in Florida, the Supreme Court turned that away, and the Seminoles do not have casinos like the Pequots. And I think the point I was making is that the Mashantucket Pequots were the first tribe under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act to sue for the right to build and open a casino. That is a fact.
Actually, they weren't not. The Cabazon were the first.
The Cabazon case is what produced the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. That case predates 1988. I mean, that lawsuit was brought long before that.
Yes,
and
it was.
In fact, that is why we have the Gaming Act today.
That's correct, and they had casino gaming before the Pequots did.
Yes, they did, and it gets back to my point, which is the Mashantuckets were the first tribe to sue for the right to build a casino after passage of the act. You know, I think we're getting away from the bigger point, though. The issue here is that in Connecticut right now, there is a line of people waiting to be deemed Indian tribes by the federal government. They are financed by people like Donald Trump.
So why does it bother you?
Why does it bother me?
Yeah.
It ought to bother anybody who lives in a community where someone is contemplating claiming they're a tribe, filing an enormous land claim, and building a big casino on it. Because once you do that, you are exempt from land use regulations, from environmental laws, from taxation. And as a taxpayer and as a homeowner, I think, or someone who sends their kids to a school that's within 200 yards of one of these facilities.
Well, they're not exempt. They still have federal regulation. There's still federal oversight.
There is no oversight for the Mashantucket Pequots. And as you probably know, on a case-by-case basis, these compacts are negotiated. And the trend today is to have less regulations.
If you looked at all the compacts, the trend is actually towards more regulation and actually bigger revenue sharing of the casinos in the states.
And the only reason there's been any turn is because people have looked at Foxwoods and saw that here's a train that's come off the tracks. And down there in Connecticut, where there's nine other people lining up to do this, there is no regulations.
I want to ask you all, maybe Matthew Snipp, you're first. Is the core of this argument really who's an Indian and what's a tribe, or is it do we want kind of an uncontrollable growth of casino gambling everywhere? In other words, if there was not the slightest question about the Indian identity of the Connecticut Pequots or their tribe or any of the legal work that had produced this casino, might we not still be arguing about, holy mackerel, how did Las Vegas plop down into this nutmeg state of rural New England and become the biggest gambling enterprise anybody's ever seen?
Is that
the question?
Well, I mean, that could be the question. I'm not sure what the question is that Mr. Benedict wants to answer. That might be one of them. But, you know, but then that gets really away from the whole issue of American Indians, gets back to this issue of what gaming is in our society, because, I mean, states and localities, I mean, this is something that has spread across the country.
Have a feeling if the Pequot Indians in Connecticut had secured their 250 acres, maybe even turned it into 2,500 acres, and were, growing tomatoes there, or maybe even manufacturing cameras or something, this wouldn't be an issue.
Probably not. I think you're right about that. I think it really has to do with sort of, you know, our conflicted and the sort of ambivalence about gaming that we have in American society. I mean, we like the revenues, and particularly, you know, rural communities that are struggling. you know, look at this as...
Well, we sort of like it, but we don't feel very good about...
We don't. Absolutely not.
Chris, I don't think there's ambivalence here, as he's suggesting. Let's face it, America has accepted gambling. I mean, there are casinos are doing tremendous everywhere in this country, whether they be in Vegas or whether they be on an Indian
reservation. For whom, no.
People who operate big casinos...
They don't do anything for me.
Well, no, I'm saying that the people who run casinos profit well, and gamblers in America are on the increase, and they like it.
And this is good?
Well, I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm simply saying that there's a...
Let's make a bet on it.
There's a distinction to be drawn here, and that is that in Las Vegas and in Atlantic City, when you open a casino... People who live around there, they're regulated, they pay taxes. The Mashantucket, Pequots, and tribes like them, the communities that host the burdens that come with a casino, i.e. crime, traffic, land use regulations, they don't have any say. And I think that's what this boils down to, is when the Congress passed this law in 1988 to open the door for casinos on Indian reservations, when people can suddenly show up and say, I'm an Indian tribe, and I have the right to build a casino, and they can do it without any controls, and they don't have to pay taxes like everybody else. That's what disturbs people.
That's absolutely untrue.
And this is
tribes do pay taxes. They pay it in the form of revenue sharing with that is written into these compacts. People do have a say because they can write to their governors or legislatures and say, do not sign off on this compact.
I think you are slightly out of touch then with the reality of what's going on here, because the federal law says that if a state like Connecticut refuses to sign a compact because they oppose gambling casinos, which is exactly what happened in Connecticut, the Interior Secretary has the right by law to impose the regulations on the state. And that's exactly what happened in Connecticut.
That is, I think, a very, very questionable interpretation of the law, because here in California, Pete Wilson was able to successfully resist the tribe's efforts to try to get him to impose a forced settlement. I think that's
there's not much resistance there now with 60 casinos going up.
No, it's not, but the state of California, the voters approved it.
And that's the difference. They had a voice and they won. There are a lot of states like Mississippi, Florida,
their legislature and through their governor when he signs it, when a governor, when he or she sits down and signs it, they represent the people of the state.
It's the caller's turn. 1-800-423-8255. The Foxwoods connection around the question of Indian casino gambling with Jeff Benedict, the author of Without Reservation. Dave is calling from Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Hey there, Chris.
Hello, Dave. Welcome.
Hey. So, you know, I think it's interesting how the show started out as a discussion of the gaming on the casinos, but it's really turned into a discussion of what is a Native American and what is it that they want. I think if you lived in South Dakota for a while, you'll find out that the Native Americans seem to want something completely different from, I don't know, what you might describe them as non-Native Americans.
Describe it.
Well, I think that their culture is so completely different from the average white culture in America that for the government to decide what they want is a question that they can't really answer.
I'm not sure what you mean. I mean...
Well, the thing is, I think we view them as an extension of Americans, but they're really Indians. They're Native Americans, and it's like trying to decide, like the American government trying to decide what someone in India would want.
But are you saying they don't want casinos? They don't want big gushers of independent revenue? Or?
I think they want casinos because of that huge amount of money that comes in.
Dave, do you think the Mashantucket Pequots are Native Americans?
You know, I couldn't answer that. I know that around here, the Sioux Indians, for all I know, are Native Americans. But, you know, this whole concept of percentage of a person's blood deciding if they're Native American, I thought we got rid of that with the African Americans. And if we're going to get rid of it with the African Americans, shouldn't we get rid of it with the Native Americans?
What do the Sioux Indians in South Dakota say they want?
I don't know. I couldn't tell you. I do know that we have a number of casinos. If you drive along the interstate, you see all sorts of advertisements for them. But I also know that last summer when Bill Clinton was out here visiting what is apparently one of the poorest places in America, the Indian reservation down there at Pine Ridge,
yep.
That I know that I would never go to Pine Ridge to go gambling. It's horrible down there. You know, the weather is awful. It seems like to be thousands and thousands of miles from any main road to get there.
Hmm.
How would putting a casino up on that reservation help those folks? And I think that there's enough internal conflicts with the Indians that for us to try and decide whether gaming is right is the wrong discussion to have.
Well, I think...
Dennis Chapabitty, do you want to leap in there?
Yes. The caller's right on in terms of the federal government setting criteria to define who is a Native American and who's not, or who's a member of a tribe and who isn't. I resent that from the fact that no one can tell me whether or not I'm a Comanche. No one can tell the other 14,000 Comanches whether they are or aren't. It's an issue that's historically and by law left to the Indians. It's a particular adjunct of their right to be sovereign governments, and we can't forget that the tribe sets a standard, the tribe regulates that standard, and the tribe says yes or no. That's something that has never been extinguished since time immemorial.
The only problem here, though, is that we're not, I wouldn't argue with you that it's, there's something offensive about having the federal government tell Native Americans who is and who aren't. But once the federal government takes it upon itself to create a law in 1988 that gives Native Americans the right to build casinos, suddenly you've got 200 petitioners down in Washington wanting to become tribes. You have to give someone the ability to determine whether these people are in fact Native Americans, or else you're simply opening the floodgates for anybody who wants to show up and build a casino to simply say, gee, we happen to be a Native American tribe, and we have the right to build a casino because of that. And I think that's totally inappropriate.
Let's clarify that. The Indian Gaming Act did not give the tribes the right to build casinos. The Indian Gaming Act, in fact, restricted their right. What gave them the right was their retained sovereignty, which was reaffirmed in Seminole and in Cabazon, and the Indian Gaming Act, if anything, only restricted their rights.
Look, I think you're complicating this for people who don't have the luxury of reading these. No, I'm simplifying it. You know really well that the bottom line here is that the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act is what opened the doors for Indian casinos.
It did not. There were casinos springing up, and there were bingo halls coming up right along the line, and that was the reason the Governors Association, after Cabazon, became so upset about it, because they knew this was in their back door, and they were trying to stop it.
We'll ask the lawyers to research this and report on it. Let's go back to the calls. 1-800-423-8255. Tom is calling from North Stonington, Connecticut. Hi, by Foxwoods, right?
Yes, I'm standing out in the rain to get good reception, so I'm going to make it quick.
Okay.
I'd like to ask Mr. Chapavitty, as a white American, how do I become anti-gambling without becoming anti-Native American, which I am certainly not? And isn't it sad how everybody's fighting for recognition as a tribe only so they can get a casino?
Well, I don't think it's sad. I think it's merely taking advantage of an opportunity, a window that's there for however long it's going to be. And as I stated before, every group in America should have a right to do that. And in this particular instance, the time is right, the equation and the combination's right for tribes to assert that right to walk through the window and to make themselves better off than if they weren't going to take advantage of the gambling environment in America today.
Dennis, just who do you think all of these folks are in Connecticut, these nine groups who have lined up to become tribes, who are in bed with Donald Trump? Who do you think these people are?
Well, they're petitioners going through the federal branch of acknowledgement process. They've got a long road ahead. One of the tribes doesn't expect to get any kind of ruling for 9 years. What do you say to that? The bureaucratic hoops are so massive and so stringent that we're throwing the nine number out there, but we don't let the person listening to the program today understand that it takes up to 25 years, if ever, for tribes to be recognized or even to get to the first preliminary recognition point.
Well, so, I think you're ignoring the fact that people who have big money backing them seem to have the ability to jump up that ladder mighty quick, because, as you know, Kevin Gover, who heads the BIA today, he admitted in congressional testimony just 2 weeks ago that he's throwing up his hands, feeling like they're unable to control this anymore because of the influence of big gambling money on
this. Yes, and I know Kevin Gover personally. I went to law school with Kevin, and I appreciate his candor. At no time in the past has anyone had the guts and the fortitude and the ethics to admit that there's something that the federal government can't handle when it relates to Indian tribes, and I appreciate his view.
I think he's talking about wannabe tribes, like in Connecticut. In fact, he referenced that specifically.
Well, let me ask you this, Mr. Benedict. I'll grant you that you weren't the person who had their hands around the throats of the Indians back 400 years ago.
Thank you.
And you weren't the person who was leading the charges into the camps and the teepees and slaughtering Indian women, elders, and babies. But your attitude still exists. The attitude, negative Indian attitude, is exists, and you're an example of that.
Well, you know, I know you haven't read the book, but I think you would be interested to know how the Native Americans who are in this book view the book, and they view it a lot differently than you have. And this is not an anti-Indian book. This is an anti-casino book in Connecticut, and it's run by a group of people who have fraudulently portrayed themselves as Indians. And I think you're just...
Are these the people who retained Johnny Cochran to...
These are the same people who have retained... They haven't retained him, but they've brought Johnny Cochran in since this book has come out to talk about suing over the things that are in the book.
I wonder if, Mr. Benedict, if you'd be happy to say let bygones be bygones to African Americans about slavery.
I would say that the principle is similar in the sense that how in the world today are you going to compensate for something that happened 300 years ago? Who are you going to hold accountable? I think that question should be asked.
Okay, we should ignore that 300 years of slavery.
Nobody's talking about ignoring it. You can acknowledge it. But, I mean, if we want to become the country that is going to compensate for every evil that's been put on people in the last...
Why not, Jeff Benedict? I mean, all sorts of things can be done in terms of education, in terms of affirmative action, in terms of business opportunity to... redress that injury, and not just for sentiment, for to make the country what it wants to be. Why not?
Well, Chris, I think the question then becomes, where do you draw the line? What about religious persecution in this country? If you take just our 200-year history, are we going to single out every person who claims they can descend from one of the religious groups that's been put upon?
That suffered a tangible injury, sure. I wouldn't let them build casinos to compensate, but I would believe in compensation. Can I, Tom in North Stonington raised this question about, it gets difficult in Connecticut to be anti-casino without sounding anti-Indian. How do the Indians feel about this? And must they be vindicated? Must they be get compensation in terms of casino gambling? Could I ask you, Matthew Snipp?
Well, for one thing, as I said, casino gambling isn't compensatory. That's a different issue. As far as casino gambling, I think it's very, very controversial across the country. There are regions in the country, my family's from Oklahoma, where gambling is still considered morally wrong. And there are many Indians around who think that gambling is morally wrong. So, I don't know if you can just sort of say that, gaming is sort of the panacea for Indian country, and in fact, I think there are a lot of Indian people who would say, no, it isn't.
Okay.
Dennis Chapaviti?
Yes. Yes, I wanted to make a comment here, and let's take a look back at the injustices. My grandmother was a prisoner of war, the Chiricahua Apache prisoner of war with the Geronimo Band. She's buried in a prisoner of war cemetery at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. She raised me as a young kid in Oklahoma, Lawton, Oklahoma, and the injustices that visited us are that close in time and in a heartbeat, and they can happen again. Now, I go back into, Mr. Benedict, the issue that if we do not make apologies and if we do not make reparations, things like this are going to happen again, and they will. Take a look at the Japanese-American internees. So the injustices are always just at an arm's length in America, and they'll pop up, and we say, so what?
It's not so what, and I don't appreciate you trying to minimize, me thinking this is a serious issue. I know it's serious, but I think you're overlooking the fact that you've got a group of people in Connecticut who run the biggest casino in the world, that they're a fraud, and that they've piggybacked on the kind of injustices you're talking about. This is doing nothing for Native Americans, the kind of which you speak.
Last word, Dennis?
Well, I hope that you've got the evidence to prove the fraud, because if you don't, Mr. Benedict, I feel for you.
I'm very confident with the proof.
Well, I would like to come in and look at it, because I would...
Buy the book.
I will, and I would also say that I could probably come in and punch just as much holes in your evidence as I do as a lawyer in any regard.
I'd welcome that. I'll tell you right now. You can.
Dennis Chapaviti, read the book. Would love to continue the conversation. Thank you, Dennis Chapaviti, Matthew Snipp. Jeff Benedict, who wrote the book Without Reservation. Connection listeners, you can continue the Indians and Casinos conversation on our website at theconnectiononeword.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Maison Robert, offering guests options of fine French dining upstairs or bistro fare in the café, with 7 private party rooms for celebrations. MaisonRobert.com.